You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. This week, we take a break from the KTEP Book Club to bring you an exclusive interview with a person who some people labeled as the king of cocaine in the 70s and 80s. My colleague, Dr. Howard Campbell, who chairs the Sociology and Anthropology Department, has been interviewed by various international news outlets and has written various books and scholarly articles on cartels and the drug trade. Earlier this year, Dr. Campbell had a conversation with a man known as Boston George and portrayed by actor Johnny Depp in the movie Blow. Let's listen now to a conversation with George Jung, who is currently under house arrest on the West Coast after being released from prison on drug trafficking charges.
My name is Howard Campbell. I'm a professor of anthropology and chairman of the Sociology and Anthropology Department at UTEP. And today I'll be interviewing George Jung, who is the subject of the movie Blow, starring Johnny Depp. And I think it's fair to say that George Jung is the most famous American drug trafficker living today. He was recently released from prison, and we're going to have a discussion today about his experiences in the drug trade and his ideas about the war on drugs and the U.S. prison system and his future work. He's going to be giving a lecture tour around the country. He's written a fictional book called Heavy, and a second movie based on his life is going to be produced. I think the backer of it is Dennis Leary, a well-known actor and comedian from Boston. Well, George, I just gave a bit of background about you and about the movie Blow and so on, so we can start any way you like or anywhere you like, but I thought maybe you could tell our KTEP audience about where you're living today and how the world looks after you've been in prison for so long and now you're out and a free man again.
Okay, well, I'm residing in the Bay Area, which is San Francisco, to those who aren't familiar with the California, Northern California area. And the world looks the same. The golf balls are the same size. The women still look as good. And the cigars taste like they always did. But the technology is overwhelming. You know, it's somewhat unbelievable. Other than that, you know, I'm still standing tall.
That's great. Now, can you tell us a bit about your new book, Heavy, which apparently is a novel?
Right. It's I started working on a project around 2004, and it was called the Cat and Mouse Game, and I was pushed away at it, and then I was ironically transferred to a place called La Tuna in El Paso, which I guess you're all familiar with.
Yes, absolutely.
And while I was there, and I received a book in the mail from Todd Cimino, and it was called Ocean's Wake and Mid-Ocean, and I read it, and I got the idea to contact him and see if he would be interested in perhaps helping me with the project as far as a book or a movie. And we had a few go-arounds, and we went back and forth for a few years, and we finally came to an agreement, Todd did a tremendous job. And the book is basically about the 80s during the Reagan era, and it transcends a Blow, and it's fictional based on historical facts with some nonfiction in it, and we hope to have a movie coming up off of it. It's on the internet now on Amazon on ebooks, and we hope we look forward to it being published, and I hope that everybody will take a look at it.
But this new book and new movie, are to what extent are they based on your actual life? To what extent are they autobiographical or based on information that you personally have?
I'd say it was 50%.
And how does that compare to Blow? Do you think that Blow is a fairly accurate depiction of your earlier life?
Blow was exact.
So then you actually dealt directly with Pablo Escobar and Carlos Leder and some of the most famous Latin American drug traffickers?
That's true.
Can you tell us a little bit about Pablo Escobar as a person and Carlos Leder? Who are these people? What were they like? I mean, how did they think?
Well, Carlos and I met through an act of serendipity at Danbury Federal Prison. He was in there for auto theft, and I was in there for marijuana smuggling. And ironically enough, they put us both together and in the same cell. And I knew nothing about cocaine. I was a marijuana smuggler out of Mexico. And we began talking, of course. And when he asked me if I knew anything about smuggling, I told him in my story. And then I said, "What's your story?" And he said he was smuggling cars down to Colombia and stealing them in the United States. And he was in there for a couple of years for car theft. And, of course, the sentences of them were lenient, and I was only in there for a couple of years. And then the Wizard of Oz placed us both about the same time to be released. And during that time, he told me the price of a kilo of cocaine cost $60,000 in the United States. And, you know, a light went off. Well, fireworks went off in my head. And that's how we began our journey, which led us to Medellin and Pablo and me being on electronic monitor 30-40 years later, talking to you, Howard.
Yes, but so Pablo Escobar, was he fun to be around? Was he all business? Was he a funny man? Do you think he was a kind of evil genius, or how would you describe him?
He was fun to be around, but he also was business, and he was very serious about the business. That seems like a necessary evil in order to maintain power.
But now, to what extent do you think all the other people in this business became sort of corrupted by that mentality, that it became about more than just making some money, but it became about power and the deaths of thousands of people? I mean, that's a pretty horrible thing, right? And didn't you feel at some point that maybe you'd gotten in too deep?
There was a point where I realized that I was in a theater of insanity, and I wanted to go away from it. And, of course, the overwhelming amount of money and power and the CIA and the KGB and billions and billions of dollars and politicians and everybody else and their brother and sister involved, you know, and to the point where, you know, violence became the rule of thumb. And I basically wanted to go away, but I was also, excuse me, caught up in the thrill of it. I was a thrill junkie, really.
But I know that you're going to go on a lecture tour and talking about your ideas about your life and about the war on drugs, and you just made some very strong statements about how the government and the CIA and various other groups are involved in some way in this thing we call the war on drugs, in ways that I think you think are inappropriate or are wrong. I wonder if you could discuss that. I mean, what's wrong with the government's war on drugs from your perspective?
Well, it's you know, it's been going on for close to 50 years, and it's cost $1 trillion. And, you know, we've come to a point where, I mean, it's a double standard now. We have drugs legal in some states and illegal in you know, to the federal government. And everyone in Colorado is walking around smoking marijuana legally, and in Washington State, and it's a double standard. And over the years, thousands and thousands of people have fallen by the wayside. And you know, I'm going to say that if you live in a ghetto, you went to prison. If you went, if you smoked dope in college, you went to spring break. And you know, it's time to for the people of this country to stand up and make some changes. You know, the Marijuana Tax Act came in 1937, and even though marijuana was not shown to be dangerous, you know, and then all of a sudden the government promoted it as a gateway drug for heroin, alleged popularity among Mexican-American immigrants, made it easy to target. I mean, the whole thing is ludicrous when it comes right down to it.
I think there's no question that there's a lot of hypocrisy and double standards here. But if we legalize marijuana all over the country, do you think that would be a big improvement? What about the fact that, well, it's still illegal in other countries? What would be your recommendation about how to do things differently?
I think that to take it off the list and legalize it, and, I mean, obviously, Colorado hasn't fallen into chaos, you know, and, I mean, you know, life goes on. And ironically, alcohol is legal, and everybody on Monday morning doesn't stop at their way. When they're on their way to work, stop at the liquor store and buy a bottle of whiskey and not never show up at work. I mean, it's obvious that, you know, this whole thing is blown completely out of proportion, and a lot of people's lives have been ruined because of it, and it's you know, and law enforcement has made a tremendous amount of money off of this, and the court systems and what have you. Those and people have been put away in prison, and basically they have a record, and then it's taken away their voting rights and disallowed them from getting a decent job, and it's ruined a tremendous amount of life.
No, I think you're right that there's many ways we could change these drug policies and also prison policies that would be much more humane for the majority of the population. And I think that you have a very excellent critique, having lived, you know, in prisons for so many years. Maybe you could describe for the audience a little bit what life was like in the prisons. Which prisons were you in, and how were you treated, and what were some of the major problems that you faced there?
Well, I started out in Terminal Island. That's in Southern California, and I was a medium facility, and then I moved on up to Otisville, which is in the Hudson River Valley, and that was also a medium, and I didn't have any problems in there, except, you know, everybody has the same problem being in there, and, you know, with huge sentences that are, you know, that are almost life, you know, taking life away from you for 10, 15, 20 years. I saw kids in there that were 19 years old with 25, 30 year sentences for a handful of crack cocaine. And, you know, and that's somewhat, the ratio has somewhat been resolved. But prison is just simply wandering the hallways of always in to a place called redundancy. And it's a sad place. And then one day after you do 15, 20 years, they give you a few dollars and a bus ticket, and send you to a halfway house and tell you to go out and get a job, you know, and you're in the land of Oz, and you don't know what the hell is going on or what to do next. And fortunately, you know, I have some wherewithal and some good people standing behind me to help me out. Otherwise, those who go out without help, the redundancy is huge, and it's almost as if it's designed for failure.
Now, I have another question. I mean, do you think that youth of today will understand the message that you're trying to bring to them? I mean, some people might say, well, he's a guy, old guy from the 60s and the 70s. You know, he was a hippie or, you know, his time has passed. But why is your story still relevant? Why is there a need for your new book and your new movie and the lecture tour? Wasn't everything already said in Blow?
Well, it was said in Blow, but I believe that if I stand up there physically and talk to the universities or what in the colleges, and it'll filter down to the high school level, and I think the key to this whole thing is education, and if you're educated about what drugs aren't, you know, a disaster unless you make it a disaster, all right? And the simple fact comes down to this. Drugs are illegal, and if you use them and you get caught, your life is going to be destroyed. And it's that simple. It's just like children don't go into liquor stores, okay, because it's against the law for them to have it, and they've been educated on that fact about not drinking. And the whole thing about drugs is the country has become overwhelmed with them. And why do drugs come here to this country? Why don't other countries have drug problems? Because this is the richest country in the world. And why are kids in high school walking around with money, huge amounts of money in their pocket that their parents give them, and to buy these drugs? If the money isn't there, the drugs aren't going to come, and it's that simple.
Well, you know, I really hope you make this second movie, because I feel that most of the recent movies about drug trafficking, especially about drug trafficking along the U.S.-Mexico border or within Mexico, are really bad unless they were made by Mexicans. That movie Savages, directed by Oliver Stone, in my opinion, is horrible. I would like to see a movie that's both more realistic, more creative, but also based on actual life. And I think that's something you can really contribute to, since you've seen this thing from the inside, both in the United States, in Colombia, and Mexico. How might your movie be different from some of these movies I'm describing? I don't know if you've seen many of these recent drug movies, but I feel like a lot of them are just sensationalistic. And regardless of who's making them, the message almost seems to be always that drugs are a wonderful, seductive thing, and it's exciting to sell them and make all this money and have all these women, and then there might be some little anti-drug thing at the end. But the message conveyed is really rather simplistic. And so I'm hoping that your movie will be sort of more contextualized, more connected to historical fact and the real on-the-ground reality of it, which is very complicated with, as you said, the excitement, the glamour, the glitz, but then also the violence, the destruction, deaths, drug addiction. So how is your movie going to be better, and what are some of the things you want to put in there that you think are really important?
I think that the movie would give, you know, factual accounts of how and why the drugs get in here, and also the ups and downs of it. And it's not an easy business to be in, especially now in this day and age. I mean, it's a very dangerous game to be playing, and you're playing with your life. And if your life isn't taken physically, they'll take you, the government will take you and put you away for the rest of your life. And anybody, you know, money in paper bags doesn't last. And an old man once told me that, and my father. And, you know, as usual, he was right. And but the movie will be truthful, and it's not going to, you know, all this glamorization of the violence and the machine guns and shooting this and shooting that, and blowing up cars and people and this and that. It's like Hollywood is, you know, actually made some of these movies that they're like video games. That's basically what they are, video games. This is far from a video game. This is life.
Excellent. Now, the other day we talked about the Contra cocaine scandal and perhaps the work of the journalist Gary Webb, and I think you have some deep knowledge of how these sorts of things might work. Do you think that actually happened, that the U.S. government was actually funneling drugs into the United States from Central America in a kind of quid pro quo with the Contras?
Well, you know what, Howard? You're going to have to watch the movie. Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it. And now, did you know that pilot Barry Seal, who was a famous pilot who apparently would bring, I think he took weapons and support down to the Contras and then would bring cocaine back into the United States, and he was ultimately murdered by, I think, Colombian hitmen. Did you actually know him?
I met him numerous times. He was from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and, you know, Barry was drawn into that whole situation with the Iran-Contra deal, and where you think you're, you know, helping Uncle Sam, and sometimes you're under the illusion that you're going to be rewarded, and it didn't work that way for Barry.
Now, who are some of the most colorful and interesting people that you met in that drug trafficking world, in addition to Pablo Escobar and Carlos Leather, people that you actually liked or you thought were, you know, basically good people in a difficult game?
Well, I don't want to be throwing names all around the place. But at the time when I started all this, you know, we were basically pioneers. And most of the people involved in it were all on a college level. And, you know, the majority of them went on their way to a different life, you know, and became model citizens and went to work at banks or whatever. And there were only a few of us who continued on down the road to hell. And it's just like, you know, it's ironic that, you know, in the 60s was a drowning in marijuana smoke, okay, which fueled the revolution that stopped the war. And the people that, you know, were born in the baby boomer generation, they're actually on retirement now, and, they, you know, they serve their country or whatever, or the banks or the Wall Street, or even some of them became president, and which... a lot of them claim they smoked marijuana but didn't inhale.
Whereas President Obama actually admitted that he smoked marijuana a lot and also used blow. That was the word he used. And so maybe you supplied our future president back in the day.
Well, I'm glad that he used the word blow. You know, it seems everybody uses it now. Okay.
Well,
but
go ahead.
Go ahead, Howard. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to ask you, I think it's at the end of the movie, Blow, or maybe it was a documentary about your life. There's a poignant scene with your daughter and how you had some sort of conflicts with your daughter over your life and being out of prison and going back. But my understanding is you're living with her now?
Well, she lives close by.
I see.
And she has a life of her own and, you know, a million miles apart from the life that I led, and we're working on trying to build a relationship, and you know it's like two people who love each other but don't know each other, and I intend to give 1,000% in my efforts to make that work, and I. You know, I believe that, you know, and in the end, we'll be more than friends, okay?
That's great. Now, in the book and in the movie Blow, there's a lot of depiction of your early life in Massachusetts. Do you still have family back there? Do you have connections to your hometown and so on?
I have numerous friends that I went to high school with, and, you know, over the years, they've kept me informed of the high school reunions, and that I, you know, that they all sent pictures and they said hello and what have you. You know, those are the guys, when I told them what I was doing, that said, "You're crazy, George." So anyway, but they've all, you know, that was a different world, and that was a world like Happy Days, where there weren't any guns or drugs, and there was only Budweiser beer on maybe Saturday night. And they all, you know, went on their way, went to college, and some went, a lot of them went to Vietnam, and they came back. And in fact, my best buddy married my high school sweetheart.
Wow.
But, you know, I keep in touch with them, and hopefully I can get back there on one of these days on Cape Cod for one of those old beach parties that we used to have before they turned the places into parking lots.
Well, you know, it sounds like you've survived pretty well under the circumstances over the years. I know your life has not been easy, especially in prison, but your basic health is pretty solid?
My health is good. I have to get some of those Hollywood implants for my, my, you know, and other than that, I should be ready to go.
Well, you're in the land of Arnold Schwarzenegger, so you'll have to get maybe some steroids and facelifts and things to fit in.
No, I think I'll stay away from that. I'll just stand tall as I am. You know, I'm at the point where you look in the mirror every morning to shave and you don't know who the hell it is.
Well, listen, George, I've really enjoyed talking with you. I think your insights are profound. Anything else you'd like to add about the various projects you're working on or anything that you're thinking about now?
Well, Howard and I haven't, after this, hopefully, you know, Heavy will be a success. We want to do something on Cuba, a film possibly about the true relationship between Castro and Che Guevara. And I don't believe anybody's ever done it. And I'm, you know, sitting here at my new desk, and I try to work on it a couple hours a day. And that's basically what's going on. And you know, when I'm able to travel, I hope to get involved in the, you know, in the public speaking tours. And I'm pretty busy for an old guy.
Well, that's great. Well, listen, George, thanks so much for talking to us today here in El Paso. And good luck with your book and the movie and the speaking tour.
All right. And I want to wish UTEP. I listened to UTEP when I was a Latooner. I was a faithful fan, and I want everybody to know that in El Paso. And I also want to, you know, say hello to a friend of mine in El Paso, the notorious Eric Hill and his wife, Susie. And I want to thank you, Howard, for your time. And as they say, you know, adios.
Okay. Thanks so much, George. Take care.
All right.
Howard Campbell is the chair of the UTEP Department of Sociology and Anthropology, and his guest was George Young, talking about his life before and after sentencing for trafficking and spending some time up the road on the 10 at a place called La Tuna. Thanks for listening to this episode of Perspectives.